You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Jonathan Pollack, director of the John L. Thornton China Center here at Brookings. And today, the Thornton Center, in collaboration with our Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies, are co-sponsoring what I think is going to be a very, very interesting and unusual event, a little different. In fact, I'd even say a lot different from the normal fare of policy debate that occurs here in Washington, if only because it is, number one, based on studies that rely on public opinion data, survey data from a variety of East Asian states, as well as survey data from the United States. So rather than having the usual chattering class conversation about China, we're going to have a different kind of conversation in collaboration with colleagues from Taiwan, from China, from Singapore, and from the United States on a very, very interesting set of papers that I think will reveal a great deal about the complexity of the questions that are addressed with respect to the rise of China. Most important, I think, it is the perceptions of mass publics that often don't receive the attention that they deserve, but they will certainly get that attention in all of the papers that we're going to be assessing today. Now, we are on a very tight schedule, so we wish we had more time, but so the emphasis will be very, very much, and I say this to all of the speakers, that we will have a watchful eye on their use of time and in order to keep on schedule as much as possible. So without further ado, let me just emphasize, you can see in the program both the sequence of events and some background on the individual speakers. What we'll do now, because so many of the presentations will involve the presentation of some of the findings, rather than have the first panel convene here, the speakers in turn will take to the podium so that they can illustrate their findings. So if I could, I guess, Liu Kang, you will be the first speaker, and then later, once all the presentations have been made, then the entire panel will come up. So our first speaker is Liu Kang from Duke University and Shanghai Jiao Tong University. Welcome.
It's a real honor and a great pleasure to be here to present the survey result, which we conducted like 2 years ago, the American public opinion on China. As a matter of fact, we just completed another round of the survey around the U.S. Presidential election. Time allows, I will try to, give you some comparative perspective. This survey was conducted in 2010 with Duke University, collaboration between Duke University and Shanghai Jiao Tong University. I believe it was the first time that a Chinese university had tried the effort to gauge the public opinion in the U.S. about China. The survey was carried out by Indiana University Survey Center through telephone interviews, random sampling. We have some theoretical issues, hypotheses, when we designed the survey. First, we would like to talk about the public opinion and foreign policy in the U.S. It's important that the American citizens express their coherent views on foreign policies, making some impact on the decision-making in the U.S., especially in the context of Western democracies, the United States in particular. Public opinion on international affairs matters. Public opinion somehow, help the politicians to shape their views and opinions. So these are the basic assumptions, you know, when we conduct the interview, when we conduct the survey. The reason we want to emphasize this is because for a long period of time, foreign policy was conceived in China as somewhat elite and secretive, disregarding the public opinion. I think it's largely still true in China. The public opinion has at best a dubious position in the shaping of foreign policy in China. However, I would say increasingly the Chinese government start to pay attention to the public opinion, if not in China, at least in the international community. As a matter of fact, our survey data, our survey result, was presented 2 weeks before President Hu Jintao's visit to the United States. And apparently, he and his staff did pay some attention to our survey report. One thing that can show the kind of increasing attention to the public opinion is that China has stepped up its media publicity campaign before and after Hu Jintao's visit. As you may recall, that the Chinese government sponsored a TV commercial on CNN, and also they put it on the large screen on Times Square for almost 2 months around the time that President Hu Jintao visited the United States. Now, some of the major questions we asked, the recognition of China's rise, is it true that the most American voters do not truly understand the significance of China as a rising and revivalist power of the of the U.S.? Do they effectively perceive the rise of China? And then there's some multidimensional views of the rising China. What are the views of the socioeconomic, political, cultural performance of China, as well as China's influence and behavior in the international community? What is their general feeling? We use this so-called feeling thermometer towards China as a development. How is it related to their views of China's performance in various aspects? Does their exposure to China-related information in American media affect this general feeling? Our assumption is the public opinion somehow is really affected, if not shaped, by the media. So that's basically what we would like to do in this public opinion survey. We actually have drawn on other existing public opinion surveys, such as the Pew Survey, Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs, and also Committee 100 also had done surveys on the perception and attitudes towards China. This is what we conceived our survey as a kind of innovative. First, we directly measured the perceived importance of the rising China as the cognitive foundation for further analysis. Then multiple aspects beyond the general measures of China's image, relative salience of different aspects in shaping the general feelings, especially the cultural values, subjective attitudes. Finally, we try to measure the kind of media and impact and the sources that the American acquisition of China-related information from different sources as well as its influence. Now, here are some of the findings. Of course, first we ask questions about the economy. Which country loans more to the other? China loans more, about the same. These are basically quite accurate assessments of what really happened in China in terms of trade economic relationship. The influence of China's politics, again, we find the American attitudes towards China's influence in international politics, world politics, as usually positive, and recognizing the increase in 10 years time. Again, you know, those are the positive and we think fair assessments of China's economy. Now, the second data is kind of interesting, the B, political system. If you look at the figure, it's something like more than 50% of the American public think that China has a political system that serves its people's needs. Now, this was the data 2 years ago. However, the data we just gathered this year significantly downgraded, somehow reflecting the impact of election years, media publicity, and rhetorics of politicians concerning the political governance of China, especially in the area of politics. One more data I want to add that is not really presented in the slides, that is, well, we have about nearly 60% of the American public recognize that China has an effective government serving its political needs of the people. We have, on the other hand, an overwhelming majority of American public, more than 87% of American public, think that China's regime withholds its political rights from the people. So, you know, we have the conflicting data, which I think is quite significant. Now, you know, we have some quite discouraging data about China's popular culture, you know, the so-called soft power, you know. Overwhelming majority of the American public do not think that China has a good popular culture. Surprisingly, China is very proud of its traditional culture, but we don't really find American public making such a acknowledgement of such a rich cultural heritage. Now, here is the question about China's overall performance in the world. We ask whether China has dodged its responsibility in the world. Now we have a large percentage of the American public opinion think that's the case. And of course, the American public do not really have very high expectations for China's democratic reform and political democracy. Now, we have this thing, it's called a fitting thermometer. Now, we compare China, Russia, India, and Japan. China is somewhere, you know, in the middle. Well, of course, it's the lowest compared to those countries. But it's not too bad in terms of its perceived position, how American really feel about China. However, this year's data, again, you know, dropped down quite considerably. You know, from this something like 46% to something almost like 31, right? 41, yeah. So we have like a 5% drop. Okay. Those are, you know, some of the general feelings, feelings towards China, but recognition of China's internationally competitive economy. Again, you know, those are, you know, fairly accurately corresponding to Americans' sort of objective assessment of the performance, you know, with this more subjective aspect of the feelings, popular culture and so on, the world politics. Okay. From the very beginning, would like to measure the degree to which the media political views expressed in American politics somehow help shaping the public opinion and the resources that the public opinion, U.S. public opinion, have drawn from the media, particularly the kind of views on China's political system. The democratic evaluation, we see generally there's some positive tendencies. The interest in China news is somewhat on the upscale. More Americans would like to visit China. Later on, we'll show you the fact that the Americans visit China, being present in China, does make a big impact on their attitudes, on their perception of China. More than any other factors, I guess, if we look at the data, overall data, cumulatively. Reading news on the news websites, we can tell, makes a big difference. Those are the categories that, different media outlets, different media channels that have different variations on the impact of China. Then we break down into their party identification and their ideologies. Looks like, Democrats and those who hold liberal views slightly favor China, in more positive ways. Here is the data that, we can tell visiting, if you look at down there, information access visiting mainland China, has a fairly significant impact on the perception of China. And of course, if you divide up different media channels, we find of course, television, has a much stronger impact on the perception of China, with its image. Incidentally, we done another survey of the journalists in China. The journalists, the Western journalists in China, how they perceive their function and their work in China. We got most complaints from television journalists. And they had the hardest time accessing information and covering China, and they complained most about the Chinese authorities' harassment. So somehow, in turn, that has some effect on the perception of China. I think this is something interesting to share. Okay. Now, some summary of the findings. The majority of the Americans can effectively understand the significance of the rise in China. We have tons of more data that we cannot really share here. But generally speaking, not simply the survey that we did 2 years ago, the survey we just completed this year also shows a increasing sophistication on understanding of the American public opinion on China. Yeah, more. Definitely American nowadays know much more about China. Then the American public's views of China are multidimensional with embedded tensions, a mix of positive, negative evaluations. What we mean here is that embedded cultural, ideological, political views do surface in the assessment of China, especially when we ask about the subjective feelings, the contradictory assessment of China's political performance, the government, that the overwhelming majority think that China is withholding its political rights from its people, while at the same time, you know, acknowledging its effectiveness of governance. So that's somehow, you know, reflection of the ideological, deeply embedded ideological and political views in American public opinion. Then we talk about the salient influence of the American public assessment of China's democracy and cultural performance. And this is what we consider with all these multidimensional factors, the cultural factor does make a big difference. A significant number of Americans are interested in China-related information and acquire such information from the mass media. Now, we have to highlight that the mass media pretty much refer to the U.S. media, not Chinese media, even though China stepped up its campaign, a media campaign. We have no idea whether that will make any difference. So that's somehow our assessment. And of course, you know, we realize that once you visit China, it makes a difference. Salient and positive influence of life experiences. If you visit China or spend some time in China, then of course various degrees of media effect. Now, finally, I want to make some suggestions based on the two surveys we've completed. First of all, we believe that a significant improvement of the American public opinion on China is quite unlikely because of the deeply embedded political, ideological issues and, you know, biases even, you know, those values and cultural factors. They're not easily going away, you know, even though you make all the publicity campaigns and try to, you know, change the mindset, it won't work. And of course, the role of the media is also quite significant. There's no way, you know, for media to change its attitudes overnight regarding a given country, whether China or Russia or whoever that is. And primarily negative coverage of China on most of the issues, if not all the issues, still largely true in the media landscape. If you look at the American media, not simply American media, but I think the Western media in general. Now, some suggestions for sufficient leeway for manipulation. The salience of ideologies, values, and cultural factors do make a difference. White recognition of China's superior economic political performance will somehow, contribute to the increasing awareness, whether or not that will have that will cast a more positive impact. It's quite uncertain. Lower hurdles for presenting China as a constant violator of human rights and an authoritarian abuser of violence, etc. Less negative coverage presumably will help China. Will help China's image. One thing we can tell from this year's survey, I think the campaign rhetoric, oftentimes, if not totally negative, but oftentimes very controversial. China was singled out as a manipulative currency. The number goes up. American public opinion think China is a big manipulator of the currency. I think that's somehow reflected in the campaign rhetoric. If you look at the countries, on the scale, India, Japan, remain the same. You know, no matter what kind of campaign rhetoric it was, didn't really change. China somehow suffered significantly from the election campaign rhetoric. So, those are the things, we would like to take a note. Maybe, I don't know whether that's a policy recommendation. I will stop here. Thank you very much.
Yes, our next speaker is Ju Yun Han. I should pay Professor Ju a specific compliment. He is, of course, one of Taiwan's most distinguished political scientists. But it was Professor Zhu who proposed this program to us, and we're really delighted that we've actually realized it today. So Yunhan, the floor is yours.
Good morning. First of all, I would like to thank Jonathan Pollack and Richard Bush for making today's event happen, especially on the morning of Good Friday. I mean, this is quite exceptional. The data my previous speaker, Liu Kang, has just presented represent, in his words, the first time effort by a university based in Shanghai to collaborate with American institution of higher education to study the public opinion about China. The data that I'm going to present here, I would say also is quite exceptional, especially in one particular regard. This also represents the first time ever collaboration between Shanghai Jiao Tong University with a regional comparative survey, which is headquartered in Taipei, believe it or not. Okay, this is a cross-strait collaboration for a scientific a study of the public opinion across East Asia regarding, you know, how they perceive the right China. Let me give you a little bit of background about the significance of this particular survey. Well, first of all, you know, we all notice that the Chinese policy elite has increasingly recognized that for rising power like China, soft power and national image management are essential aspects of its foreign policy agenda. As a matter of fact, that the CCP Politburo organized what they call the collective learning session as early as 2004. They invited speaker to talk about soft power, okay, which means that officially, you know, this concept entered into the Lexington lexicon of Chinese policymaker. And then later on, Hu Jintao, in his official political report to the 17th Party Congress, which is more than 5 years ago, mentioned that China needed to enhance the soft power of its culture. And at the same time, we have also noted that China has invested billions of dollars to cultivate and upgrade its soft power resources. For instance, that, you know, it set up hundreds of Confucius Institute around the world, set up 24-hour CCTV cable news channel, and also you know, put a lot of effort in organizing the Summer Olympic in 2008 and also Shanghai Expo 2010. And at the same time, it vigorously promote the Boao Forum for Asia as a very high-profile regional forum that get a lot of attention. And also, we there's no question that China has get a lot of attention throughout the region. There has been growing interest among ordinary citizens in the region. There are more people that, you know, they pay news, pay attention to news regarding to developing China. But also, we see increasing number of people, you know, they register in learning Chinese. And also, I think, especially after the 2008 to 2009, the subprime loan crisis, China suddenly emerged as the locomotive of the economic recovery in the international system, and especially for its Asian neighbor, it overnight, you know, it emerged as a buyer of last resort after that financial crisis. But to what extent, you know, all this effort and also the fact that, you know, it has really become a very influential economic player in the region really helped to improve its image among the Asian citizen. And that's, you know, where you really derive your soft power. As Joseph Nye correctly pointed out, that soft power depends on the willing interpreter and receiver. there are other observers might question that, you know, despite the fact that everyone, you know, recognize the ascendance of China, but whether it can convert its economic and political might, you know, into favorable image about China, or a lot of opinion leader and even ordinary citizens in the region, they might not be persuaded by its stated foreign policy objective or strategic attention, and much less attracted by its political system. However, there's not that many survey data around, you know, that we can verify or to put our finger on this very important issue. Pew Global Attitude Survey is, to my knowledge, the only cross-national survey that collects public opinion data on people's image about China on a regular basis. However, Pew, over the last few years, they cover only four countries in East Asia, Japan, China, Indonesia, and South Korea. 2 years ago, they dropped South Korea, and last year, they dropped Indonesia. Okay, so now you only have two East Asian countries covered by Pew. And the BBC Global Scan, which sporadically, not systematically, covered view on China in most recent one, 2012, it only also covered these four countries. So that's why we argued that Asian Barometer Survey, which is headquartered in Taipei, filled up a very important void. You know, it was administered in 13 East Asian countries and territory. So it covered the bulk of East Asia. East Asia broadly defined, that also includes Southeast Asia. And on the basis of countrywide probability sampling and face-to-face interview, and what does it mean? Okay, not only suggests that, you know, this is scientifically a very reliable instrument for gathering the public opinion data, but it also means it's very expensive. Okay, imagine that you have to do face-to-face interview in countries like Indonesia. Okay, a country, you know, stretching over, more than, 2,000 miles, you know, from east to west. Okay, and also I think that, this is probably a very important effort that, you know, we want those people, their voice may not be always heard in the public discourse or in the public opinion reporting. Because everyone have an equal chance, you know, that, you know, being heard in this kind of survey. I'm going to do a little bit of propaganda here. You know, welcome to visit our website. We publish a lot of electronic working papers. And also we make those public data eventually, you know, after a certain period embargo to all users in the social science community. The survey, however, was not conducted, you know, exactly concurrently, but due to a lot of logistic difficulty. So it stretched, you know, this latest wave from the later part of 2010 until the early part of 2012. So within about, roughly about 18 months span. And then there are a couple of questions, you know, I want to share with you, which are very revealing. Number one, we ask people, you know, throughout Asia, which country has the most influence in Asia now? Okay. I would say it's very interesting to see, China itself, you know, stuck right in the middle. Okay. 44% of the respondents, think that China is already, the country has the most influence in the region. However, they are remaining 25% consider the United States, is still the country that has the most influence in the region. And then you can, most of the country which are, in my, expression, which are adjacent or neighbor, with China, they tend to feel very strongly, you know, how influential China has become. Okay. Like in Vietnam, 69, versus, only 16% of Vietnamese respondents consider the United States, you know, has the most influence in the region. Taiwan, 67, Mongolia, 66, Japan, 61, Singapore. So Singapore is the only country which is not really adjacent, you have many, many buffer, the country, between. But you can argue that, Singapore, for a lot of reasons, has been, although not geographically adjacent, but, it's culturally, economically very, close to China. So the China influence was also much more strongly felt. But except for Singapore and Vietnam, then the rest of Southeast Asia, I would say, still consider United States has the most influence. Although, there are a substantial number of people in Thailand, in Malaysia, also recognize China as the most influential. And interesting that the country where the influence China has been least felt is the Philippines, the former U.S. Colony and a country with a very close cultural tie to the United States. Another round is Indonesia. So Indonesia, Philippines, you might consider they are part of what we call the maritime Southeast Asia, which has somewhat different view. And then we ask the next question, which country will have the most influence in 10 years? They are given four choices, Japan, China, United States, and India. However, Japan and India, never really emerge substantially. So then you could argue that, overwhelmingly throughout Asia, except again in Indonesia and the Philippines, that the great majority of East Asian people consider China will have the most influence in 10 years. And the Philippines still, persistently believe that the United States will remain the most influential country in the region in 10-year time. Indonesia is kind of divided, 31 versus 33. So basically, you can argue that the ascendance of China has been widely recognized, especially it's about its future prospect. Then what about their evaluation, their assessment? The question we ask is twofold. First, we ask, how they will consider the impact of China on the region. Is generally speaking positive or negative? And then next we ask, what kind of impact you think China has on your own country? Generally speaking, positive or negative? To our surprise, actually, that's what our survey data show, that the impact of China on the region has been, by and large, positively perceived by a large number of Asian countries, especially countries located in Southeast Asia. Obviously, China, feel very good about itself, right? almost 100%, which is, well understood. But countries like Singapore, Philippines, Cambodia, Thailand, Indonesia, and so on and so forth. Now, obviously, it was surprised no one that, Japan is where China's impact, gets most unfavorable, the perception. Only 19% of our respondents consider its influence on the region, is largely positive. Mongolia has very difficult relationship historically, with China. And I would say, to my surprise that even, among the Taiwanese, 59, consider the China influence, in the region is overall speaking, is positive. But nevertheless, once again, it's quite an interesting coincidence there. Among those countries, in the Northeast Asia, which is very close to China, they, on the one hand, they recognize China's influence, much more so than people in Southeast Asia. At the same time, their assessment of China's impact is, relatively speaking, less favorable. So this is what I call the phenomenon of too close for comfort, you are more far away, and on one hand you don't, feel you know, it's present so strongly. Same time, you don't, you feel less, you know, threatened, or worrisome. Then we also ask question of the, how they perceive the impact of China on their own country. The difference between these two charts has something, I have to say, has, you know, have something to do with, you know, for the first question, there are more people who answer don't know. No opinion. Okay. Because for them, you know, how to evaluate China's influence region is more difficult. Okay. But this one is more easier, you know, so that's why it's one of the reason is kind of a technical reason. But let me, you know, especially highlight the outcome in Korea and Taiwan. You can tell that the population are kind of divided. Okay, right in the middle. About half our population seeing, you know, the impact of China on their own country is largely positive. But, you know, the reverse side of the same coin, you know, telling you that another half are not some, is not that, you know, favorable. And obviously Japan also, again, you know, ranked at the lowest. Let me compare, our survey with other available comparative survey. Okay. I would argue that, you know, probably, first of all, you know, the wording, of those questions is not, purely identical. Okay, so it's not strictly comparable, but I would say by and large functional equivalent. Although you can tell that, you know, the absolute level can fluctuate quite a bit. You know, like Pew survey, you know, in Korea, you know, can be hover around, you know, above 38 in terms of favorable perception to like 53. Okay. Within the range, okay. But the pecking order, consistently stable over time. Okay, Japan, the lowest, then South Korea and Indonesia higher, and obviously China always feel very good about itself. Okay, so it tells you the robustness, you know, our survey, you know, although it's not identical with other survey, but by and large it's kind of very consistent. Now, I know my time is already up, but I try to stretch a little bit beyond the time limit. Okay, what explain, you know, why some people they look at China more favorably, other people less favorably? Okay, not only you know, within the same country, but also you know, a huge difference, you know, among country. Theoretically, you can argue that, you know, there are at least three sources. Okay, one is the geopolitical and security consideration. Okay, you know, whether view China as a military threat, you know, whether there's territorial dispute, things like that, or you know, more pure economic calculation. You know, China represents as opportunity versus challenge. Whether the economic change relationship is essentially compatible or competitive, whether they view the relationship as mutually beneficial interdependence or kind of lopsided dependency. And lastly, I would argue that ideological and cultural consideration is also very important, whether they perceive their core value, you know, overlap with China or just opposite. Okay. Let me give you some data. This is not, you know, a rocky sign, okay? And this is not definitely not perfect linear relationship. But nevertheless, you know, if you measure, you know, how they play China on a scale, 1 to 10 point scale, you know, from the complete undemocratic to complete democratic, about their own country and about China, and then you calculate the gap, okay, the difference. Okay, and then I calculate the national average of that, what I call the democratic distance. You can tell that Japan thinks that, you know, is far ahead of China in terms of level of political development, democratic development, okay? But countries like Mongolia, Thailand, Indonesia, and Philippines, they don't see that much different, you know. Although Freedom House might say things very differently, okay? This is a public image, okay, public perception about, you know, where China stands on the scale of democratic development. By and large, you know, countries, especially Taiwan, Korea, Japan, you know, they consider themselves as far more advanced in terms of democratic development. Okay. They tend to have, relatively speaking, less favorable view on the impact of China on their own country. Okay. But again, I say this is not a perfect linear relationship. another what we call the cultural distance. That is, you know, we try to measure what we call the Asian value, you know, the emphasis on harmony, you know, hierarchical relationship, emphasis on collective, you know, versus individual right, collective obligation, you know, versus over individual right, things like that. And then again, we calculate the national average on this traditionalism scale. And here, actually, you have a stronger linear relationship, okay, which means that those countries that, you know, they share more of those kind of traditional Asian value with China than basically, you know, might like, you know, the China a lot more than those countries, you know, who, you know, believe in a very different kind of social value from China. Because, so this a very important explanation. But always, you know, the economic factor is always, you know, important in this regard. And this is the relation between how they evaluate their own economic condition, their own country economic condition. It happens that, you know, those people, you know, and also especially those countries where majority think that their economy is doing not very well, okay, like case in Japan or Mongolia, okay, then the same country tend to have less favorable view about China influence. So you might argue that, you know, people who consider their economy doing well, then they tend to attribute, you know, part of reason has something to do with their growing economic tie with China, and vice versa. You know, if they consider their economy is very sluggish, you know, doing poorly, they might partially blame on China for their own problem. So I think I pretty much used up my time, but let me just try to draw one conclusion. I think what we have just shown here suggests that the public opinion we observe is, I would say, is largely compatible with the long-running policy pursued by a great majority of East Asian countries. Contrary to the theoretical prediction of neorealists, most of Asian countries avoid pursuing either a balancing or bandwagon strategy. In the face of the intensified strategic competition between China and Japan, China and United States, you know, but also between China and Japan, most of them avoid having to choose one side at obvious expense of the other. Whenever possible, they opt for maximizing benefit from deepening economic ties with China while maintaining a close security relation with the United States for hedging potential risks. Maybe, you know, the only case which doesn't really quite fit my generalization would be Japan. Thank you for your attention. Yeah.
Could I ask both paper writers and the discussants now to come up on the stage? Very pleased to have both Bob Sutter from George Washington University and Satu LeMay from the East-West Center here in Washington to provide comments this morning. So I look forward to their remarks.
Well, I guess we'll start from this end of the table since we hadn't prearranged. Thank you, Jonathan and Richard, for the invitation. Thank you for the paper presenters. It's a pleasure to be on this panel. Look, there's we've been given 8 to 10 minutes, so going to be very conscious of just laying out a few things for the discussion to follow, because the papers are extremely rich, very interesting, lots of things to look at. I sort of focus my points mostly on the East Asia paper. Five or six things. First, I think it is really interesting that the survey data does public opinion survey rather than elite survey. To my mind, that was one of the most interesting things, because over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of policy discussions at the elite level, and this brings the public thinking into it. And I found that very interesting. One of the things that stood out was the generally very positive view in Southeast Asian publics, according to this data survey, versus elite views that I have encountered in the region. And that struck me as an important point for maybe further discussion. And I was particularly surprised by the gap between my impressions and travels and interviews in the region at the elite level versus the public level, because the timing of the surveys was a timing in which there was a particular intensity regarding China's relationship with the region. Yeah, we can all periodize this differently, but let's call it from roughly the summer of 2010 when Secretary Clinton went to the ARFS summit and made a statement about maritime issues for the first time, and then subsequently up to the president's visit in November at EAS for the first time that we attended EAS. So I think the timing combined with the gap between public and elite perception on my point was one thing that stood out very strongly for me. And I know that this is an ongoing discussion about views. We have David Chambaugh's piece suggesting, you know, kind of, I don't know if he gave the title, but called Falling Out of Love with China on the one hand versus Mr. Chaz Freeman's new book called China, America, and the Shifting Balance of Prestige. So there's an ongoing discussion about this, but I think it's worth delving a little bit more into this public elite gap and seeing whether it really exists, because I think it has all kinds of policy implications for the United States, which I'll get to. The second theme that sort of caught my attention in this study was the lack of a mainland Southeast Asia versus a maritime Southeast Asia gap. Yinhan referred to this. There's some gap if you kind of dig deep into the numbers, but a general conventional wisdom has been that China's role in mainland Southeast Asia is much richer, deeper, more expansive than American role, for reasons that we've been essentially re-engaging in mainland Southeast Asia, Burma most recently, but even the rest of what might old times used to call Indochina, quite recently compared to China, which has had an ongoing presence, and we are re-engaging. So that made me want to pull that thread a little bit more and find out. Now, Myanmar and Laos data is not included, so that might change things a bit, and it would particularly change things after the re-engagement of the United States with Myanmar over the last 14 months or so. This has a very important policy implication to my mind, because the rebalance to Asia is in part, at least in my mind, has a very heavy Southeast Asia ASEAN component in terms of ASEAN centrality for regional institutions, emerging partnerships with key countries, which are mostly in Southeast Asia, for opportunities to develop new relationships, and a rebalance within Asia to Southeast Asia in terms of military posture, rotational forces, et cetera. So I think this has a very important element in the survey and merits digging more. And if it's true that the public elite divide is, as I said in point one and as the data suggest, on the one hand, it suggests more constraints to U.S. and regional elite cooperation than I previously thought there might be that I've seen over the last 12, 15, 18 months. And this is important because elites in those countries, even if from an elite level, may wish to do more things with the U.S. as part of the rebalance, and we've seen that in Singapore, we've seen it in Indonesia, we've seen it in the Philippines, we've seen it to some extent with Vietnam. They may be constrained if their publics aren't on board to the extent that they have a much more positive view. And I think, again, that, you know, merits sort of digging into. On the other hand, it's very interesting that Southeast Asia, on average, and particularly currently, sees the U.S. as more influential. And that caught my attention because it kind of militates against the first finding about the gap. And that suggests to me a whole bunch of things about the way we might look at this. But first is, in terms of timing, if it's a time of great, when the survey was done, of great intensity in maybe concerns about China, it was also a period, it strikes me, in which American commitment to Southeast Asia in particular was extraordinarily high. Ratifying TAC, joining EAS, going to ARF, et cetera. So I would bear that in mind. And it has implications for how far we can go with our emerging partnerships in the region. Because what it suggests is there's quite a lot of, on the one hand, there's a constraint because of the public elite divide. But on the other hand, because most Southeast Asians on average see the U.S. role now and in 10 years higher than Northeast Asia, it allows more scope for the United States to pursue the rebalance and emerging partnerships and cooperation with Southeast Asia. So that might be well worth flushing out. I'll leave aside the business of outliers simply for time reasons. I mean, there's the I don't mean this in any way. The peculiarities of the data on the Philippines kept coming to me because there's issues of cultural, geographical proximity, democratic distance, U.S. relationship that weren't entirely clear to me. On methodology, without going into a great detail, there are two things that struck me. One was I puzzled a little bit, Johan, about the definition of influence. Influence, if you ask someone influence, on the one hand, you don't want to get deep into sort of dissecting it. On the other hand, yeah, some element of what that means would have been more useful to me, particularly in evaluating the welcoming nature of these attitudes. And the second methodological concern I had was there weren't specific questions about Chinese policy with which to evaluate. It was sort of, if you look at the questions and the papers are available, it was focused on the evaluative factors, democratic distance, cultural proximity, et cetera. But I think you don't need to go into policy wonkdom to ask the public questions about sovereignty, about ownership of territories, about aggression or non-aggression, or however one wishes to refine the questions. But I think those might have given us a little bit different or more qualified findings, which are particularly, as I said, quite surprisingly positive in that time sector of the evaluation. So what's kind of my net assessment? My takeaways are sort of three. One is, this data survey, both the American and the China and the East Asia paper, inevitably kind of have the implication, though I'm not suggesting you mean to do this at all, of a zero-sum approach to China and the U.S. role. And I think that's a fundamental problematic. My interactions, both publicly and with elite levels in across the Asia-Pacific, is they're more concerned not about whether who's going to be top dog, but the relationship between the U.S. and China and everything that flows from it. And we all know it. Not too hot, not too cold, sort of the Goldilocks U.S.-China relationship for everyone. That segues right into the region's demand for a U.S. presence, but a calibrated supply of U.S. presence, not over-presence, not pushing people to say, let's take it against China. So I think that, to me, the issue isn't China influential or U.S. influential or positive or negative, but how the U.S. and China manage their relationship with each other and with the region in order to create an environment that fundamentally doesn't undermine East Asian interests, which I hope is America's interests as well. And I certainly would think it would be Chinese not to do that. So that's and then maybe this is a little controversial, but my own assessment is, this has nothing to do with the survey, but relates to the survey. At the current time, U.S.-China relations, and I think I found support for this in the region, U.S.-China relations and U.S.-Asia relations are generally better than China-Asia and inter-Asia relations. Please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying U.S.-China relations are fine. I'm not saying all China-Asia relations are bad. I'm suggesting that if one does a nuanced balance, that on the whole, where we are now is that the U.S.-China and U.S.-Asia relationship is balanced in a way that maybe the China and inter-Asia relations are less positive. That's all, and we can certainly discuss this. On the U.S. point, I would only say that we have a project at the East-West Center. I hope you'll get online and see it, AsiaMattersForAmerica.org, which looks at every state and congressional district, just two pieces of data because we are doing governors and local visits, is if you look at every state and congressional district in this country's interactions, there is one standout on every variable we look at: travel, tourism, trade, jobs from exports, exports, FDI, students, study abroad, et cetera. And it's very simple. It's one word: China. The increase since 2010 is 40% of all governors have gone to China. State legislators going to China. I was just in Indiana. They started a Kokomo Greater Economic Development Association linked up with the U.S.-China Alliance to build trade and investment relations with China. So whatever other issues, and clearly there are issues and quite reasonable issues of democratic governance, human rights, et cetera. Most Americans are looking for a very pragmatic way to engage China and to maximize the gains, knowing full well there are trade-offs. There's one district is losing jobs because of something that's going on in China. Another district is gaining wildly because they're able to export or they're getting investment to build something that then gets exported or what have you. So I think there's a very interesting relationship, and that's all I'll say on the U.S. So my time is done, and I thought I'd just lay out those things to put them on the table for the discussion to follow. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me to be on. Thanks to the sponsors for inviting me to be on the panel, and I very much enjoyed the presentations and reading the papers. And Satu, I also associate myself with Satu's remarks. I think they're it's my experience as well that in private conversations with government officials in the Asia Pacific region, you get a very different perspective. So this perception, there is a perceptions issue here, and I'm not sure exactly how to explain it, but you get a very different approach toward the United States than you do when you deal with the kind of data we're dealing with today. But the data today has profound implications for American policy, and we need to take a look at that. We're in Washington. We always look at the implications for U.S. policy. But some basic points on the studies. These are very important studies. Both of them, and they reinforce and advance the earlier work that's taken place in these areas. I'm not fully familiar with this earlier work, but I do follow both of these issues, and I'm going to refer to some earlier studies and how these studies relate to where we are now. And then I will talk a little bit in each case about the implications for U.S. policy. First, on the how Americans view rising China. Just to review the points that I found most salient, they show an awareness on the part of the Americans of China's strengths, and they project strengthening of China in these areas. They show reasons why Americans marginally disapprove of China. They more than disapprove than approve of China as a government. They show the weaknesses of China's soft power, particularly in the areas of culture and media and this type of thing. And they show that these things aren't going to change easily, that these are long-standing trends that are likely to continue. it seems to me that these reinforce, the findings of this study reinforce the understandings, which I thought, for those of you that haven't followed this, there's a really good book on this called Living with the Dragon. It's a wonderful book, summarizes all these different polls. Professor Nathan has a foreword to the book. And it really underlines some points, which I think can help, and I think the survey is consistent with that, and it cites this, among others, the other studies that deals with. The American publics are reasonably well-informed about China. They basically favor pragmatic U.S. engagement with China with a full awareness of all the differences that the United States has with China. China is neither an enemy nor a friend. It's a rival for economic success and for global influence. And what influences American opinion, according to Page and Shea in this Living with the Dragon book, and I think it shows forth in the study that we're dealing with today, is that Americans are influenced by different values and by economic competition with China. they dislike the Chinese government, and they want to compete, but they don't want to confront China. And so they want to get along. And I think that the one area that the current study and the Page and Shea study show something that's important, the Page and Shea study, Living with the Dragon, shows that security issues are most important for the United States. Security, economic, and values, in their judgment, are the range of issues. And this study doesn't deal with security. And that's the issue that's most likely to get Americans excited about China in a critical way. And so you might want to think about that anyway, including that in the study. On how the East Asians view rising China, when you have the experience like Satu has and I have, when you go around and you're talking to government officials throughout the region privately and so forth, and in this kind of study, Americans are just overwhelmed. And so in perceptions, America is losing. And so America has to – you have to adjust to this. Do I like it? No. Do you have to adjust to it? Yes, you do. It's a reality that we have to deal with. How meaningful is it? That's the question you don't know. You don't know how meaningful it is. But the perception power shift comes through very strongly in this study, and it's consistent with other things. This isn't an anomaly. CSIS did a wonderful study about 4 years ago looking at this issue from the elite point of view and saying, yes, all the elites in Asia that they surveyed thought just the same type of trends. China is the most influential country, and it will by far be the most influential country. Now, unlike this survey, which is a very good survey, and I think it's great, and I hope they continue doing it, the CSIS study looked at the role of the United States. And the role of the United States was sort of a hedge for these people. In other words, they said they didn't know about China. The idea that China might be dominant, domineering, coercive in some way was very important to these elites, and therefore they wanted the U.S. to stay there. They wanted the U.S. as an anchor to deal with this situation. And so this was so while there was this pervasive impression, perception that China was very important and that the U.S., the CSIS study identified the U.S. role. Now, that really didn't come out in this study until your last slide that you showed today, where they don't want to choose between the United States and China. But otherwise, it didn't show up. And I think that I'm not sure it should, because it is an element that one needs to consider. So when we look at the policy implications on the U.S. survey, looking at the U.S., the implication is the Americans will be mixed in their attitudes toward China. You're not going to advance U.S. relationships easily with China. Americans are going to be suspicious of China, but they don't want trouble with China. And so pragmatic interaction on the U.S. side, I think, is very likely to be supported by the American public for a whole range of pragmatic reasons, not because anybody particularly, not because the mainstream of Americans like China, this type of thing. On the other survey, what this shows, this perception, could show that if you take the perceptions as reality, then you say, okay, what does this mean? It means the future of Asia and China's role in Asia is in China's hands. It's up to China. And so if China behaves in a certain way, if it emphasizes a benign approach and it's not aggressive in any way, it is the most influential power, and the others don't matter much, well, then all it has to do is be nice. Just be nice. And so the main impediment there is China can't be nice all the time. It has trouble doing this. It has conflicting interests. But the implication is that's all they have to do. And the implication of this for the pivot for the Obama government policy is, well, you can try to reengage in Asia, and good luck, and I hope you do. But if China's benign and it's the most influential power by far, well, then it's not going to have a big impact. Now, maybe you won't have the zero-sum type of competition that Satu was talking about, and you just have this emerging order with the U.S. playing a role, but China being overwhelmingly dominant in the region because it's so benign. And so if I were in Beijing and I were talking to Mr. Xi Jinping, I would say, you know, get your act together, stop talking about territorial disputes, be nice to everybody, and this study shows you'll dominate Asia. Just do that. You see? And you know, you're laughing because it is far from reality, I think. And so I think that we need to keep that in mind. We need to understand, yes, there's this perception. Great. Yeah. But we can get swept away. I said, would somebody show me a survey of Asian opinion and this sort of thing about Japan in 1987? You know, I would suspect that the survey would show Japan dominating Asia. This was called the Japanese Lake in Southeast Asia, as you may remember. But anyway, I don't want to get into that too much. But the point, the implications, I think, are clear if you take the surveys very seriously, and I think you should take them seriously. But perceptions are only one dimension of what makes things go in the region, it seems to me. And then just one small point, having worked with Americans, taught people who are getting ready to go to China, The visiting to China, it could be an important element in how people think about China, but I think they've already self-selected. They're going to put down $6,000 easily to go there. And to do that, they have to sort of like the place. They generally don't do that if they don't like it, if you see what I mean. So I wouldn't emphasize that too much, if you see what I mean. Some people have to go, and they and you might get a different view. But by and large, these people all want to go. And I think if they want to go, they're going to pay, and they're going to like it, generally.
There will be time for just a very few questions, because I believe there is a plan for a coffee break, if I'm not mistaken, at the request of several people. So, but yes, I see a question in the back of the room. Could you identify yourself, please, and direct your question as appropriate?
Sure, thank you. David Ahn, State Department, Office of Regional Security and Arms Transfers. I work on East Asia. Question on the East Asia barometer, especially for Professor Zhu Yinghan, is with East Asia barometer, I understand that it's ongoing. You've been doing it for several years. I feel like the presentation was more of a snapshot, and also one that discussants mentioned former Secretary Clinton's comments in Hanoi in 2010. About the maritime territorial disputes, but I'm more curious on if there's any. Like longitudinal or time series cross-sectional observations. If you noticed any interesting findings comparing 4, 6, 8 years ago, so where we are now, considering where we've been, rather than just over the past year or two. Thank you.
Yunhan, you want to?
Number one. Asian barometer have incorporated this battery about how Asian perceive China and United States only during its third wave survey. We have done two previous survey starting from year 2000. Unfortunately, at that point, we haven't recognized that this is going to be a very interesting and important question to ask. So from this point on, we are planning to do survey, the next round survey next year. So it would be very, I hope that, you know, maybe 2 years from now, Johnson and Richard will sponsor this event one more time. You know, we can report back to this audience, you know, whether, those variable image, you know, stay the same or I can actually quite, you know, suffer a lot, you know, from the recent tension. Right. So basically, yes, it's going to be longitudinal as long as you know I can get funding support. And if the department want to pay for it, you know, we definitely welcome. You know, and we can incorporate many more items. You know, to answer the kind of questions that too, you know, are more interested, more qualified question. Yeah.
Yes. Right there.
Jeffrey Lim from Senator Angus King's office. I'm directing this one at Professor Sutter, and sorry I didn't take your class last semester. It looked fun, but I had other academic priorities. So essentially I'm wondering, as you've noted that the Asian states, especially the elites, are looking to U.S. more as a hedge, especially in terms of security, but I was wondering if they'd like to see more U.S. involvement, especially in economic development, opening up economy via the TPP, for example. The prospects on that.
Bob, you want
to? Sure. I think the American engagement with Asia is very multifaceted and is welcomed broadly by many in the region. And I would also point out that the Americans, unlike China and unlike most societies, don't rely on their government to interact with other parts of the world. It's The American society is so interactive with Asia. And so this dimension and business is a big part of this. So you have a program to go forward with the free trade agreement. That's great. It looks politically very important. When you compare government to government, when you're dealing with China, it is a government-led operation as far as interacting with Asia. When you're dealing with the United States, it's heavily non-governmental. It has always been that way. And so you get all sorts of interaction by business, media, foundations, universities, and then immigration in the United States that just changes the nature of the American society and integrates it with Asia. So So this is an ongoing feature of American involvement, but it isn't. A lot of this isn't governmental, and so it doesn't get a lot of attention that way.
Yes, a questioner here on the.
My name's Edgar Gordon, no affiliation. I'm just wondering whether, to take up the point, Professor Sutter's point, whether China can be nice, given the fact that it seems to be using its nationalism or pursuing nationalism as a means for legitimatizing its current government, just the way using economic development as a way of legitimizing its current government.
You're on.
No. They're very conflicted, and it's going to take them a long time to work this out. And so it's worse than you think. The nationalism is very well understood. The sense of image in China, China's been building an image in foreign affairs ever since Mao Zedong took over in 49. And this image building has focused on China being correct in foreign affairs, following principles in carrying out its foreign policy, which lead to a moral foreign policy behavior. The People's Republic of China has never acknowledged that it's made a mistake in foreign policy. And so the neighbors of China don't believe this because they've experienced China again and again doing things. But the people in China, in my experience, believe it. And the elites believe it. They really think this. And so you talk about a constraint on behavior that we've been talking about in the region. This is a big constraint on the leadership of China to make a reasonably flexible approach to dealing with the disputes they have with their neighbors. Whenever they try to move in this direction, they run up against public opinion, elite opinion in China that says, you're too weak. You're not being strong enough in defending our righteous position because our position is righteous. And they can't address this issue. They never address it. And so until they do that, they're really going to have a problem in meeting the other parties halfway in the area. So I think it's going to take a while, it seems to me. And and I don't see the beginning of the process yet. So I think that's why my short answer, no.
This would be a very, very appropriate moment to break the discussion. We wish we could go on. There will be a third wrap-up session, so even if the second session will also be equally data-intensive, there will be opportunities for other questions. But we should all give all of our speakers a good round of applause.